at that same number is Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. No, Sandy, Ukraine and you know, to just envision the fact that while we're sitting here on the air and that there are people fighting, you know, ground wars, right? Major ground war. I can't even envision that. I mean, I always think back again to, you know, those great old army movies, military movies, and I remember you even talking about this one in this real war, and you were talking about, for the first time, you're going to see these crumpled buildings, these buildings that have been brought down to rubble in real life, in true life, right? You know, you see those in the 50s movies, and, you know, you don't think much of it, but that's when you finally realize that hand-to-hand, it's not hand-to-hand combat yet, but just that kind of thing, where there's not a lot of movement, but a lot of destruction. That's just where they are now, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the sort of urban combat that was had in Kyiv, which
probably, it's still going on.
Well, no, that probably favored the Ukrainians because it was unknown turf, and now what they've got is much more like artillery warfare, which is more distant, less hand-to-hand, more about sort of destroying wide areas,
yeah.
So that and this is where the Russian artillery might is providing them with significant advantages.
They have more artillery, I remember reading, than the United States.
Yeah, they have more artillery than anyone in the world. And so, you know, it's a war, and the war is going to go the way that it goes, and it's ultimately there's going to be a center of gravity in the war that's going to favor people who have strategic advantages. Manpower-wise, it's going to be relatively close because, as we were saying off the air, Ukraine forbade the emigration of men, I think, any younger than 65 from the country because they understood that manpower was going to be an important asset and that it would be important that many men be available to fight in the war. I think they have now a head count of potentially 1 million people committed to the military and armed to varying degrees. Russia, you know, it's not an advantage. Certainly, it's always a disadvantage to be a country at war. And the country attacked and defending itself has a great deal more public support, possibly, than a country that is pursuing a war for ideological or political purposes, but not on its home turf. And so the political problems Russia has with respect to raising its army and creating a high manpower necessary potentially for this war is different than that faced by Ukraine. In Russia, one goes through the military, young men all go through the military in a draft process, but then they are all exposed to the military for essentially their whole entire life and can get called up in the same manner that we call up our National Guard. Here, the National Guard commitment might be for 6 or 8 years. In Russia, it's for essentially their adult life out through what was, I think, age 40, and now I think it's age 60 or 65. Politically, Putin is going to be reluctant to call up all of those folks because of the real impact that will have on so many people inside the country, and they'll begin to scratch their head and maybe ask more questions about why. I think the prognosis for the war is that it's going to go a little differently than the world thought. I continue to believe that the long-term outcome from the war is going to be as I thought it was going to be, which is that ultimately Russia will prevail in getting most of all the things that it wanted before it began the war, neutrality of Ukraine, recognition of Crimea as being its own, and some differential in status for the Donbas region, Luhansk and Donetsk. And I think that is ultimately going to happen. But there's apparently going to be a great deal of bloodshed and physical damage that's going to occur in the interim. And in large part, I think that's because of the enablement that's occurred for the Ukrainians to resist what is what I think is inevitable.
You know, Sandy, I remember when they were massing at the border, the Russians, and having been through a couple world wars, they know what real war is, right? The Russian people, you know, their forebears knew what real war was, and Putin knew what real war was, and he knew when he made a commitment that is no turning back. Right. And so they're in it for the long haul, whatever it takes, however long it takes, whatever the resources, whatever the manpower, whatever it is they have to use. They're in it for the end of it. Right. I mean,
well, I think so. I think the question is, what is the end? And you know, what is the negotiated settlement that would be satisfactory? You know, it is true that much like the United States left Vietnam unsuccessfully, Russia left Afghanistan unsuccessfully. And so it's not clear. But the question is, what is the principle that Russia is fighting about with respect to Ukraine? And I do think that there, the principle is much different than the principle that involved the conflict they had in Afghanistan. And the principle in Ukraine, at least from the standpoint of the people making the decisions, Putin and whoever else works with him on that, they believe that they were dealing with existential issues, existential to Russia. And they believe that it involved a problem created by NATO and NATO's presence. Whether we think that's a rational outcome, the important thing is whether they thought it was rational and whether they were being rational when they developed their concerns. And I think there's a case to be made.
So, Sandy, if you follow that way of thinking, then you would say that Russia at no point is ever going to be just satisfied with Ukraine.
No, I think that's not true. I think that to the extent that they could get a satisfactory outcome in Ukraine that would assure Ukraine's neutrality, and if they could get NATO to back down on the sanctions, for instance, this risk to the Kaliningrad that I talked about last week, Kaliningrad, this enclave on the Baltic that is separate, that is Russian but separate from Russia, that puts at risk the concept of that puts at risk the flow of materials to Kaliningrad and puts at risk the notion that Russia and Lithuania could be in combat with one another over the opening of the Salwiki corridor there. If that could all be cleared up, and the long-term and short-term risk of that kind of problem more or less eliminated, then I'm not sure that Russia would have any stake in doing anything more than what they've done. But to the extent that they would feel that the pincer is on and that they are going to be isolated, not just with economic sanctions, but with embargoes and blockades, then they might feel differently.
So I'm trying to see this, Sandy, from the perspective of Zelensky. And Zelensky, I'm assuming that he's thinking, look at what they've done. Okay, look at what's happened to this country, to my country. And I'm not going to accept, you know, any of the things for the most part. We haven't gone into Russia, sent a few rockets there, but little or no damage has been done internally to Russia. Look at what they've done. They've devastated our nation. I'm in no hurry.
Well,
you can't have that kind of thought when you're...
Well, he might have that kind of thought, but he probably also knows...
It could get worse.
Well, no. that he probably also knows that he could have negotiated, and I think he was interested in negotiating. My understanding is that conservatives in his government made it clear to him that he would not be supported in a negotiation with Russia. But I'm pretty confident that he knows that he could have negotiated a settlement when he was surrounded by Russia but not invaded by Russia. He could have settled for neutrality, recognition of the annexation of Crimea, and some clarification that went beyond the agreement that had been reached with respect to the Donbas region, because there had been an agreement reached about an autonomous status for those regions in the agreement that was reached in 2014 at an earlier time that Ukraine had signed on to. So you can say that he might have that thought process now, but he also probably also carries some guilty knowledge that he could have settled without the invasion for things that he might well be called upon to settle for now.
And history will bear that out. I mean, there's nothing that we see now or he can say now or anybody else can say other than we hear people talking about how great a man he is, that he's resisted. You know, and him personally, he gets a lot of accolades from the rest of the world, but to what expense? You know,
yes.
is what that comes down to. And I know.
Well, to what expense, and at what expense, and to what outcome? I mean, what is the ultimate outcome going to be? And what was the expense born for the difference? You know, what difference did that the expense borne by Ukraine make in that outcome? And so, you know, my view is, again, based on this realpolitik concept of pragmatics. And from a pragmatic standpoint, I think that Zelensky's decision-making process here needs to be called into question.
So, Sandy, when we get back, I want to talk with you and change the subject about the state Supreme Court and some decisions that they made about elections, if we can. The decisions about the drop boxes, all these other things, and what your thoughts are. 844-967-2789. Sandy Williams in the studio. We'll be back.